of us have discovered our long-time hidden cooking talents since the start of this pandemic. Now, as provinces in Canada enter stage 3, restaurants reopen and frozen food shelves are filled up again. But does that mean we should return to our old habits of ordering from restaurants and eating convenience food? What has the pandemic taught us about food sovereignty? In this episode, we are talking with Indigenous culinary leaders who will share their experiences of contributing to Indigenous food sovereignty and how every one of us can contribute as well. Rick Paulus is an Indigenous chef who has been in the food industry for 27 years. He is also a chef instructor, teaching high school students the skills they need in the food industry. In the near future, he is going to start an Indigenous culinary project on the Six Nations Reserve that teaches various culinary and food processing skills. So what made you decide to start this culinary project?
I'm very much an advocate for, you know, scratch cooking. When I became a teacher, it was something that I really wanted to instill in my students was we can eat healthier, we can eat better by making food from scratch, using fresh ingredients, whole ingredients, instead of convenience foods, going to places like McDonald's, which we all know is the food's not great. It's not good for you. When it comes to food security, it is a real issue because grocery stores at the time were being shut down. What were we supposed to do? This is where teaching these life skills, teaching people how to cook from scratch, how to resource your food sources can actually get you through times like this.
So what are those kind of skills that you wish to teach in this project?
So this project that I'm working on, it allows students to learn real life skills, teach them how to safe food handle. At home, people don't wash their hands like they're supposed to. People don't clean their cutting boards or clean their knives like they should. You're bound to go home after eating at someone's house and say, I didn't feel very well. There's a real good chance you may have gotten food poisoning. I'm not saying people are bad cooks, but safe food practices are very important to us. So I'm going to be teaching that. But I want to partner with programs that teach us how to forage. You know, we have a world full garden out there that doesn't cost anything when we forage. We can forage mushrooms, different types of plants that are edible. Nuts are edible. Traditionally, we used to process these ourselves naturally, and we would use them for cooking. And we've gotten away from things like that. So we're going to try to look at how to forage, how to prepare those foods so that we can become more self-sustaining.
So in what ways do you expect this project to impact the food sovereignty of your community?
The way I'm looking at it is I want people to feel that when they get up in the morning, they have a garden that they've got to tend to, that they can grow all their vegetables. They have that food resource that's handy to them, because that, in the end, food security is about having the financial means, having the social means, and the physical means to get to accessible food. When you're looking 500 years ago, our people, before microwaves, before a lot of technology, we went out to our fields and we plowed and we planted and we harvested. We have, in our traditional ways, we have ceremonies for harvesting, for planting, for the different gifts that we're given. And it's important to maintain those values when we're looking at food security, because it brings us back as a whole person.
So you mentioned that this project is aimed to improve food security. Would you like to share how secure is food right now on the Six Nations Reserve?
Guesstimating a number, I would say 10% of the people here even have a fighting chance. Okay. We depend on being able to go to the grocery store. We depend on the vehicles that we have that work. We depend on our water being safe. If this pandemic kicks up again here in Ontario, the first thing that's going to go is drinking water, is all the bottled water. That puts communities that are on boil water advisories in a really tough position. And we saw that prices started going up on these things. That financially, the money's not there. One of the things I think people forget about when it comes to food security is water. Here at Six Nations Reserve, we were on a water boil advisory for almost 15 years. I mean, how does that happen? You know, and we're in an urban part of the province. I can't even imagine what it's like to be in a rural area where you can't have drinking water, where you have to boil water just to make a cup of tea for medicines, because our plants are our medicines. But if you can't have, if you have to constantly boil water just so you can take your medicines, I mean, we got to stop.
So what kind of food sovereignty initiatives are happening on the reserve during the pandemic, or has there been any kinds of initiatives happening?
I don't want to make it sound better than it is, because it's not. But the blessing with COVID is people actually had to stop and rethink about that. What are we doing? How are we going to do this? We've got people sitting here that know how to do this. And I've seen a lot more people on this reserve here in Southern Ontario actually start planting gardens. And we've looked towards our elders to say, okay, what can we plant? How do we plant? And they're starting to share the information. They organized, what they did here at Six Nations Reserve was they had this community project where you signed up for it, and they would send out a barrel that was cut in half. They sent three bags of sod and some seeds. And what you did was, once you signed up, they told you, I believe it was the middle of May, you got the phone call, okay, we're coming out, we're dropping it off. And they did this big community garden grow. So what's happening is every family that signed up is now growing something. And whether you share it or not, it's irrelevant. Right now, they're getting us back into this. The elders had a hand in that. They said, we got to do something here. What are the questions you want? We need to figure out how to become more food secure. So, yeah.
So you just talked about growing gardens in the community and this project that is helping the community to become more self-sustainable. But in my knowledge, I know that protecting natural resources is also a huge part of building or creating a more self-sustaining community. So do you think the government has been supportive on protecting natural resources?
Without being political, I'm going to say yes, I'm going to say no. Yes, because they make the promises. Okay. Attawapiskat is a very good example. They're supposed to move them. They had all this money to help them. They've made all these promises. Have they come through? No. And if you're going to make a promise to us, come through. Show us, you know, good faith. Don't sign a small check and hand it over and say, here's the start. The politics, it's irrelevant to me. And I'm sure in the end, it's irrelevant to a lot of people. We just want back what we had. If we have hunting rights, let us have our hunting rights back. Hunting rights are part of who we are. It's our way of life. That's a part of our food security. It bothers me when people say, but you guys hunt too much, you fish too much. No, we've never done that. Our hunters here at Six Nations Reserve when they go out hunting, they only get what they need. They provide for their family. That's how it's supposed to be. We don't hoard things. You know, there's hunters out here. I've got one guy, because I don't hunt myself. I know he's a hunter. He's part of the Ministry of Natural Resources has a group, an advisory group out here, and he's a part of that group. When he hunts and he gets his meat, he'll put a call out, and yes, he'll charge, but he's charging because of the processing that he's had to go through to get that. But he's not trying to rip us off. He's sharing what he's got. I've never gone to him and paid a certain amount of money and that's all. He gives extra because he knows he's feeding his community. And when we need meats for communities, for ceremonies, the hunters, they give willingly. They don't charge. That's what we do here. That's what across this country, that's what we do.
So how do you foresee the future of Indigenous chefs like you to take part in the larger food sovereignty movement?
We're very fortunate that in the past couple of years, there's been a huge push for Indigenous chefs to come forward. I always thought I was such a minority in that respect. And then 2 years ago, I went to a food summit, and there's all these Indigenous chefs, and it almost made me cry because I thought, I'm not alone. There's a lot of us out there. Now we have to step up and teach our people how to prepare these foods. They're doing it in Quebec. They're actually starting to post how we traditionally cooked our fish after we caught it and how we prepare it to serve. It's amazing to see this stuff. That is what we have to do to start the food security process. And it's going to take a long time. This is not going to be something that's going to happen in months. It's not going to happen in the next year, but we have to start somewhere. And social media is a great place for chefs like myself to come out and say, here we go. This is what I've made. What do you think? Do you want to learn how to make that? I'll teach you how to make that. And that's what we're doing. That's what we're trying to do.
What are the expectations that you have for your culinary project once it kicks off in your community?
This program for me will be geared only to Six Nations membership, and it will be served on reserve. This way, the community actually has access. They don't have to go off reserve. They don't have other people teaching them. They're going to have their own people teaching this. If I can get one person to say, I know how to cook at home and not make people sick, I've done my job. If I can get one person to say, gardening is not that hard, I can do this, and it's a part of my program, I've done my job. And I get one person to say, I don't want to eat that food anymore, I want to eat our food, I've done my job. All I need to do is reach one person. It's important to come back home in my way. Because I was born and raised in the city. So half my life, I didn't realize who I was. I had no understanding of who I was. And I've spent the last half of my life trying to get that back. And I'm in a good place, you know. I'm educated. I've got 3 degrees. It's time for me to give back to my community. It's time to help them so that they don't have to depend on other people to take care of them. Food security is the best possible way for me to do that. I can't build a house. I can't fix a car. You know, that's what people do. But for me, I can cook. And I can cook our food.
Billy Alexander traveled around the world to learn culinary skills and share Indigenous cuisines and cultures. Upon returning to Canada, he founded the Indigenous Culinary Associated Nations and became the first ever Indigenous consulting chef for the WestJet Airline. This year is his 20th year of being a head chef, and Alexander is currently the executive chef of the Three Fires restaurant.
So, Mr. Alexander, in what ways do you share Indigenous cultures and history through your culinary experiences?
Yeah, we try to make, like I try to make through my culinary experiences, them as interactive as possible. So we never look at food as just like an ingredient. So if something is on the plate that goes back out, it usually has some historical or cultural significance to who we are. So we always make it kind of interactive to when we serve that to tell about it, whether it's a sacred herb or whether it's a spiritual animal for us that carries some meaning past just eating. One of the things about Indigenous culture is and food is that almost nothing has only one purpose. They have multi-purposes and many platforms. So it's interesting to think about food in particular that it's not just about something being an ingredient. It's all of the other purposes that it carries. So it gives us a lot of opportunity to share and teach who we are as well.
So you are an Indigenous chef who has shared Indigenous food cultures all over the world. Do you feel that your Indigenous culinary experiences have been well supported as you traveled?
What I found is, Canada's 153 years old this year. Around 3 years ago on Canada's 150th birthday, there was a lot of awareness that was brought to Indigenous. There was a lot of questions and that topic was front and center. And what that did was is it allowed a lot of Indigenous businesses to kind of start up because there was a really forefront interest in Indigenous cuisine. You look at, there are some longstanding existing Indigenous restaurants in Canada, but a lot of the Indigenous restaurants and newer age chefs started within the last 3 years of cooking their food. A lot were classically trained or trained in other genres and were chefs in their whole life, but just started doing Indigenous food. And it's not because we didn't think it was important. We always knew Indigenous food was important, but we didn't realize that there was a huge part of the world that actually wanted to know what Indigenous food was, how they could have it and where they could experience it. So I find that there has, through my experiences in WestJet, through my experiences as an Indigenous chef and working with organizations and traveling and consulting, it's always extremely well received. People really want to know, they want to know what it's about, and they want to learn, and we've always received really, really high and good feedback on how it tastes. So the truth is I've, from a guest perspective, I've always felt really, really supported by people and the interest, and that's been in Canada, and that's been from international tourism as well. The travelers have always been really enamored with the Indigenous culture and dancing and artwork and food. So I've always felt from an individual level, really, really supported. From a government level, it's a different experience for every person. So there are grants and there's been more awareness and more money put into Indigenous business and development than ever before in the history of Canada. So I believe it's trending the right way. Obviously, selfishly, I would love to see more. But we are better now than we were 3 years ago, and we just got to keep moving forward.
You just mentioned that you want to, you would love to see more support from the government's level. What policies do you wish that the government can implement in the future?
Yeah, I would like to see some policies more put towards around, like there have been some good things done, and the natural realization and revitalization of areas and food areas is something that I think could improve on a little bit more. From an Indigenous perspective of things, I would love for us to be able to hunt traditionally and be able to naturally preserve our own resources, and because of some of the laws and attributes that are within our country right now, those rights are harder and harder to do. I think I'm a big fan of the preserving of the natural lands and having not everything turned into commercial and buildings And I believe that the government has made some good grounds with this, but there's always room for improvement on more sustainable grants for sustainable food and local food being growing. And then some of the techniques that are being put in place for sustainable growth, more vertical growing as opposed to land mass growing where you just need hundreds and thousands of acres. So I'm liking some of the new initiatives, but I'd love to see more capital and grants available for businesses to start doing this so we could kind of start building vertically for production instead of having to rely on import-export.
You just talked about that you would love to be able to hunt traditionally. So I'm wondering, how has not being able to hunt traditionally impacted your culinary experiences?
It's interesting because when I referenced before about us not being able to hunt and sell that food, so what's happened is like, it is true that ingredients have become very difficult because now as an Indigenous person, I'm forced between trying to serve food that represents who I am or going broke in order to do it and then not being in business anymore because the food's been so expensive. So if I go out to hunt a moose and buy moose or caribou, for example, if I go out to buy a caribou or hunt a caribou and I want to serve that in my restaurant, I'm not allowed to do that. But if I want to buy a caribou from a farmed caribou, it's over $100 a kilogram to serve that caribou. So the truth is as Indigenous people, we know there's an abundance of ingredients. We're not allowed to use them and sell them. So that's where it's become very, very difficult. I have tried and am still trying to change this. I have sat in meetings with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. We are trying to work on the regulations to make things more accessible and to make it so we're allowed to represent who we are as Indigenous people without having to pay the price to make us not do that. So I do think it's a progress. In Halifax, they're allowed to serve wild game. They're allowed to serve hunted food. They're allowed. I think I'm looking forward to a time whenever Canada can just do the same things as an overall country.
So at the very beginning, you talked about how you felt that your culinary experiences have been very well received and supported as you traveled. Do you think that can increase people's awareness on natural resource protection as well as Indigenous food sovereignty?
Yeah, you know, I think that like we grow up with a grocery store mentality, right? That the shelves will always be full and that somebody stocks that shelf and we never know much more about our food. I think through the teachings and the respect that's paid through food and through us telling our stories about how that food has always influenced us, the sacrifice that was made, the preparation that went into it, and what it truly means, I'd like to think that we'd like change people's perspective on food and make people maybe have a greater interest in caring for it and respecting it. And we know we talk about food sovereignty, but honestly, to really talk about food sovereignty, we have to kind of go a step backwards. We have to realize that you can't have food sovereignty without respect for food. So in order to really achieve this idea of like maintaining and improving food sovereignty around the world, well, what do we really have to change first is our respect and appreciation for food. And when that increases with it, we get better results. I always say, I have an interesting quote that's like, we don't realize how much food we accidentally walk on every day. And because it doesn't come in a package and because it doesn't come on a grocery store shelf. I've always said that we need more knowledge and teaching. And if we teach and give people more knowledge, that will make them powerful. When people feel powerful, a good percentage of those people will start to make the right choices with their power. And ultimately, at the root and base of all food sovereignty and our culture completely, it is respect for food. We believe inherently that we have a relationship with Mother Nature. It's what Mother Nature provides to us and how we respect that. If we take things for granted, Mother Nature will stop providing for us and we won't have the things we need. Everything comes for us for respect. And that is ultimately why Indigenous people believe so highly in food sovereignty. We didn't call it food sovereignty before. We just called it respect.
So as you just talked about, food sovereignty really requires the support from every community member. What are the actions do you think people can take or should take to contribute to Indigenous food sovereignty?
I think just in regards to food sovereignty, it's something that's just going to take a lot of effort, and people often don't know how to help. One thing I would say with this is if you really want to start looking at food sovereignty in a really, really simple way, plan your meals at home. Only buy the groceries for what you need for your plans and see what you waste a year. I believe CBC Canada in 2017 published a report that said like 70% of produce that people bought in Canada was wasted and went in the garbage. Fad diets about people wanting to be healthy, so they go and they go to the grocery store and they fill their fridge with vegetables and then they don't eat those vegetables and we order pizza instead and then those vegetables go in the garbage. That's not food sovereignty. So one thing I would challenge people to do would be this. This is the easiest way to start to contribute to food sovereignty. Look at your next grocery list. Plan your meals that you're going to eat. Try to actively make a grocery list that only plans into that list and buy that list. And if you're going to have fast food twice a week, just plan that into your week and see how many groceries you buy versus how many you waste. And I promise you, food sovereignty starts there in every house. Because if you can control what you're planning to buy versus what you're wasting, you will always be in control.
Thank you for listening to this episode. This episode is produced by Nancy, and I would love to thank Rick Paulus and Billy Alexander for their support.